This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Madeau, and we are talking about self-sufficient organic gardening on the show today. Our guest is Elliot Coleman. He has over 50 years of experience in all aspects of organic farming, and he's the author of The New Organic Grower, Four Season Harvest, and The Winter Harvest Handbook. And his latest is called The Self-Fed Farm and Garden, A Return to the Roots of Organic Method. What questions do you have for Elliot about organic gardening? And we can take other vegetable growing questions too. So give us a call. Our number is 800-642-1234, or you can send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. Elliot, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
I don't know what the weather is like in Maine, but here it's going to be in the 60s in southern Wisconsin. It's kind of odd to be thinking about that, but how has your weather been on that side of the world?
Similarly, much warmer than normal.
Mm-hmm.
By Thanksgiving, I'm usually skating on the pond, but it doesn't look like it'll be that way this year.
Yeah, it sure doesn't seem like it, does it? Now, many people know your name. You're a leader in the organic gardening movement. Basically, you were organic before organic was cool. What got you interested in gardening that way?
I read a book written by a Vermont couple, Scott and Helen Nearing, and the book was entitled Living the Good Life. And it was very, very popular during the 60s, and a lot of us hippies read it and and decided, oh, that seems like a cool idea. Let's get into growing vegetables. And they were doing it organically, so that part was an easy choice.
Sure.
And once I started, I was so fascinated by how well this worked, despite the fact that all of the experts I was reading were putting it down, saying that can't possibly work to do it. And on my garden, it was working.
Uh-huh.
So that was a holy cow moment.
Yeah. So what were other gardeners doing, the so-called experts at the time, that was different?
Well, they were probably PhDs, mm-hmm. and that isn't to suggest that these PhDs were ignorant. I think that they were probably misinformed or miseducated, because the belief in general among agricultural experts was that it was impossible to farm, and especially to farm commercially, as I wanted to do, unless you used chemicals and pesticides, and we were using neither.
Was that due to the kind of not switching crops around, growing one type of product or crop, depleting the soil? Was that the reason they had to bring in all the extra stuff?
Yeah, I would say the organic theorists at the time would have assumed that the fact that they were running a monoculture,
mm-hmm.
and were not returning organic matter to the soil. There are a lot of old books. In fact, you know, I have on my shelf the 1895 yearbook of the USDA. And it has a long chapter in there when it says exactly that, the secret to long-term success in agriculture is to make sure you return enough organic matter to the soil.
So you've been doing this, like we said, for a long time, since the 60s. When did you see a real turning point where it was almost mainstream for organic gardening? It was something that most people had heard about.
Yeah, I think the change came after the Alar incident, when it was exposed that the chemical orchards were using a chemical called Alar, and it was suggested that this was a carcinogen. And at that point, everybody, even those who had no interest in gardening, rushed to their supermarket or to their health food store and wanted to buy organic vegetables. And so that was really the beginning of the interest in organic.
So how do you feel about the organic label? I know it can mean different things to different people. And how do you feel about those labels?
I work with a group of farmers. Most of them are all the old-time, long-term organic growers in the country. And the organization is called the Real Organic Project. And all of us are objecting to the fact that the USDA, which was given control of the word organic, has basically sold it out and are allowing produce from hydroponic farms and from confined animal feeding operations, so forth, to be sold under the organic label, and especially the hydroponic stuff, since in hydroponics, there's no soil involved, and in organic, the important thing was how good care you took of your soil.
Right, and I had not even thought about that until I read your book. And yeah, how can that be organic when there's no soil there? So how should they be labeled if they're not organic?
Well, they should be called hydroponic, which... Okay. The hydroponic industry understands that customers are not running to the store to buy hydroponic produce, and so they have tried to hide what they're doing by piggybacking on the organic label, and they managed to subvert the truth at the USDA in order to allow them to do that.
So one of the main things in your book is talking about seeing the farm as a living organism. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, that was brought up originally back in 1924. When Rudolf Steiner gave a series of lectures, those lectures were the initial background for biodynamic farming. And the whole idea, the whole idea behind organic, in addition, is that the key is to have a biologically active, fertile soil that can digest the organic matter you put into it because of all its microorganisms and everything. And that is the power that makes an organic farm work. And, it appealed to Steiner at the time that was part of the farm itself being alive. And so that was the whole idea behind what he was stressing.
And healthy soil is good in what kind of ways?
Well, the idea of a healthy soil in organics has always been one fed with clean organic matter that you grew on the farm, and either collected together and made into compost and spread the compost on your soil, or if it were a soil-improving crop that you tilled into the soil to mix that organic matter with soil particles that would then help break them down and make those nutrients available to other plants in the future.
And where does, like you said, manure and compost, and you obviously believe that they should come from your own farm. farm rather than bringing them in. Why do you think it's more important to figure out where they come from rather than the fact that you use them?
Well, a lot of the manure available today for organic farms who are looking to purchase it is coming from confined animal feeding operations, CAFOs. And this manure is filled with the wastes of the drugs that are used on the animals in those places, but is also very suspect because these animals are all locked away in huge barns or cages somewhere. And the whole idea of organic is that the organic matter that you're putting in your soil to make it fertile enough to grow vegetables is pure, is not polluted. And a lot of the compost available for purchase today comes from municipal waste compost, which is made in many towns with the leaves they collect and the grass they collect and everything. But all of those inputs for the compost come with unintended pollutants. And so many of those composts are hardly the pure compost that most people would like to see their vegetables grown in.
So it kind of comes down to you knowing where everything is coming from and kind of controlling that.
That if you want to be responsible to your customers and provide them with vegetables that are as close to perfect as you can do, that is exactly the thing you should be concerned about.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, we're talking with Elliot Coleman. He has over 50 years of experience in all aspects of organic farming and is the author of many books on organic gardening, including his latest, The Self-Fed Farm and Garden, A Return to the Roots of the Organic Method. What questions do you have about organic vegetable gardening? We would really like to hear from you. So give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Stay with us at noon today. Mark Dwyer will be back with suggestions on how to enhance your winter garden with color and texture. Right now, we are talking about organic gardening with Elliot Coleman. And Elliot, the whole main focus of this book is basically it talks about green fertilizer, cover crops. Talk a little bit about what that is and how important it is to gardening.
Yeah, probably a better name than green manures are soil improving crops. And these are crops, very often legumes, but they can be grasses, that are grown on the farm. And when they are of a certain maturity, are tilled into the soil to add their organic matter to the soil. And as I've mentioned earlier, adding organic matter to the soil is the way you keep it alive and productive for a long time.
And we'll talk about the use of tillage in just a second, but we do have Dave in Appleton with a question. Go ahead, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm not sure if this is a question that you've asked, but this program, it's about biochar. During the winter, I make biochar in the wood burner, and the only thing I can do is spread it on top of the ground in the winter. And then during the summer, when I plant plants, I take it and put it around the plant when I plant it. Is it okay to leave it on top of the soil? Is it better around the plant? And how does that help the plant?
Okay, thanks, Dave. What do you think, Elliot?
Well, the whole idea of biochar originally was to mix it into the soil. And it came about because people have discovered along the shores of the Amazon very, very fertile soils. And what makes them more fertile than the other ones near them is the fact that they're filled with charcoal, and that goes under the name now of biochar if people want to make it and try this concept. Whether lying on top of the soil it would be as effective as when it's mixed into the soil, I cannot say.
Okay. Well, good luck, Dave. I guess maybe experiment, right? You do things like that on your farm, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I experiment all the time. But I had a quick question for you, Jill. Normally, you would talk about books that are how-to. This book is a why-to. Does that change anything in the way you think about asking and accepting questions?
It's a what? I missed the...
Yeah, this book, the Self-Fed Farm and Garden, uh-huh. isn't a how-to. I mean, it does explain how I do it.
Right.
But it's mainly explaining why think that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, that makes sense to me. Let's talk to another caller, Bill in Deerbrook. Go ahead, Bill.
Hello. I agree with you 110%, and I thank you very much for telling the truth. One example I have is about 12 years ago, I tried to grow vegetables, small vegetables organically, and I live near a CAFO, and they spread manure next to my property, and it saturated my soil so much that I can't grow garlic, squash, or anything anymore, and I have no idea what's going on in my soil because every year they just keep spreading, and I'm broke. I'm out of business.
Oh, that's too bad, Bill. Elliot?
Yeah, well, by most people in the organic world, manure is considered an excellent soil improver. But obviously, like anything else, you can have too much of a good thing. And if the manure that's coming from the CAFO near where Bill lives is not processed properly, it can cause all sorts of trouble.
Sorry about that, Bill. That's so heartbreaking. Unfortunately, there's not as many regulations and things for CAFOs as there could be on that. Do you have any problems in your area with those large farming organizations, Elliot?
No, in fact, being on the main coast, which isn't the Midwest with huge farms, mm-hmm. All the farms around here are small farms like ours. And the only large farming is wild blueberries, and that's done quite extensively. But basically, this is a... You would call the farming around here pretty old time. It harks back to the way things might have been done 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So we were talking about tillage. So to your point, why do you use tillage on your farm? A lot of people are saying you shouldn't do that anymore because it brings up the seed weeds or the weed seeds. But how do you use it on your farm and why do you use it that way?
Yeah, I have always tilled on my farm. In fact, I wouldn't have a farm here, a functional farm, if I hadn't tilled organic matter into the soil from the start. We cleared the land that we're farming from spruce and fir forest back starting in the early 60s when we moved here. And land cleared from spruce and fir forest is not notably the most fertile land you're going to find. In fact, this soil had a pH of 4.3 when we began here. It was very sandy and low in organic matter. And so basically, we needed to create this soil before we could successfully farm it. And we did by mixing as much local organic matter. And I can get all the spoiled hay I need around here because so many of the old farms are now owned by summer people, and they have no need for the hay, so they hire contractors with bush hogs to come in and mow the fields around their houses to maintain the farm look. And I'm smart enough to suggest to them when I chat with them that it's very dangerous fire hazard to leave all that dry, flammable grass around your house. And if they want me to come collect it, I would be happy to do it. So I can get all of that I could ever want.
Very kind of you to do that. Great idea. We've got a call from Gianni in Montello who's got a question about fertilizers. Go ahead, Gianni.
Yeah, we also are in an area here in south central Wisconsin where the soil is quite sandy, and I do my best to bring in leaves and organic matter, but I do buy the 10-10-10 fertilizer for our garden in the springtime, and we use it for the corn and the potatoes and all the plants. Can I still be considered organic?
Oh, dear. Well, originally, Gianni, the whole idea behind organic growing was that you didn't use soluble fertilizers, and most of the fertilizers like 10-10-10 that are sold are soluble. In fact, in order to make the rocks that contain phosphorus available, they are treated with sulfuric acid to change the insoluble phosphorus into a more soluble version. And so that was the concept that was followed by the early organic growers. Their preference was to use phosphate rock, the rock that is mined to treat with sulfuric acid to get superphosphate. And, as long as you're putting plenty of organic matter into the soil along with your 10-10-10, you're probably not committing any horrible sins, even from the organic point of view, because many of the chemical companies back years ago were very aware that their chemicals worked better in soil with plenty of organic matter in it. So your combination of the two is probably not that bad.
Okay, Gianni, I guess you've got the okay from the expert. So, now, in Gianni's case, though, what are some options that he could maybe have on a smaller garden or a medium-sized garden that would continue to make his soil healthier without having to add in the extra fertilizers that he's buying?
Well, the bags of fertilizers, the 10-10-10, those numbers stand for certain amounts of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Now, in my book, there is a section where I reprint, let me just find this here so I'm quoting it correctly, a pamphlet printed back in the 1940s by a well-known professor of agriculture, in which he said, the air above every acre contains 70 million pounds of free nitrogen. Why are you trying to buy that? And if you think of it for a minute, that is exactly true. And one of the crops you can grow to put nitrogen in your soil is a legume like clover. And you turn that under once it has nodules on its roots, and you would have the nitrogen in your soil. If you got a hold of rock phosphate, which is the most basic form that phosphorus is sold in, it is not looked upon favorably by the chemical people because it isn't instantly soluble, but your soil can make it soluble by all the biological activities that go on in your soil. And the third suggestion made by Cyril Hopkins in this article I was reading is that there are 30,000 pounds of potassium in every acre of normal farmland. 30,000 pounds. And so, again, if you're going to try and get by without chemical potassium, all you need to do is figure out how to make the potassium your soil already contains available. And you do that by making sure there's plenty of organic matter, which means plenty of life in your soil.
Okay. Thank you for explaining that. I mean, this makes sense in so many ways, in that organic farming, budget-wise, can be tight, and not having to purchase something from outside of your farm makes less sense, right?
Makes great sense, mm-hmm. Yes.
So let's talk about this, how we get our soil healthy and basically create our own fertilizer. What's the first thing that needs to be done? What did you do when you cleared your land and you had to enrich your soil?
Yeah, well, the first thing I did was spread limestone because, as I mentioned, the soil under a spruce fir forest in Maine is very acid. The initial pH of our soil was 4.3.
Good for blueberries, so, right?
Yeah, that's why it's blueberry land once it's cleared, unless people want to do other things with it, as we did, so we had to raise the pH. The second thing we added was phosphate rock, which was obviously the easiest way to get phosphorus in there, because once we had lime raising the pH in the soil, we could then grow legumes. Legumes require a soil a lot sweeter than that 4.3 pH. And so we were then taking care of creating our own fertility from what we didn't need to buy, although we did buy the phosphate rock, but from what we could grow in place, which is green manures and cover crops, which then we tilled into the soil to mix them with all the soil particles. The reason that works, and I explain in the book, when organic matter decomposes in the soil, as it will after you till it in, it gives off carbon dioxide, which everybody thinks is something bad. But if carbon dioxide is given off by decomposing organic matter in your soil, it then mixes with soil water and creates a very dilute acid known as carbonic acid. And this acid is given off by plant roots and other things and has been in the soil for millions of years. And it then is there etching minerals out of the soil particles. The soil particles are all small pieces of rock that have been ground up in one way or another. And the key to having a fertile soil is to be able to get a hold of those minerals in your soil. And if you have plenty of organic matter in the soil, you have plenty of carbonic acid, and that's making everything work. And that's the theory that we operate on, and it seems to be very successful for us.
We're talking with Elliot Coleman. He's the author of many books on organic gardening, including his latest, The Self-Fed Farm and Garden, A Return to the Roots of the Organic Method. If you have questions about organic gardening, wondering about the method, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. So let's talk about some of these the plants that you grow for green manure, as we were mentioning. What are some of the best ones, and what do they do for the soil?
Well, basically, they all are adding organic matter to the soil. And let's start with a combination of two, one legume and one grass. And the legume would be hairy vetch, and the grass would be rye grain. And the nice thing about this one, you can plant it later into the fall than any other. In fact, the type of weather we've been having, you could still get out there and put it into the soil. Mm-hmm. And these are very hardy plants, and they will germinate at quite low temperatures. So I think you could establish it now. You then leave it there all winter long, and on as long as you want to next summer before you mow it. If you mow it first, it makes it a lot easier to till in that that rye straw. Mm-hmm. And then wait a couple of weeks, and it will be breaking down and making available the nutrients that it has put into its straw and leaves from the normal things that help stuff grow, like photosynthesis and so on. And that is probably the simplest one. Green manure we do use a lot is a combination of peas, field peas, and oats. And we usually sow that in September. Mm-hmm. And we leave that over winter. And it is a great soil protector, but also it has another benefit for those who might not want to till. It winter kills. And so it protects the soil even after it has winter-killed with its dead leaves and stems. But then next spring, and one of those crops, the pea, is a legume. So you have put nitrogen and organic matter into your soil. And when it's dead after the winter, you just rake it aside next spring. You don't have to till. You can just put seeds in the ground, and you've already done a pretty good job on preparing your soil for the new crop.
How often do you do that to your soil? I mean, do you have certain areas where you're going to be using growing like that, and then some others that you're be putting in vegetables? Do you trade them around?
Yeah, the on our farm, about a third of the farm every year is growing winter storage crops that are harvested in the fall and then go into the root cellar. Mm-hmm. And so on that land, that's where we use the rye and vetch, because we can plant them late after we have harvested all of those winter storage in the cellar crops. But on other parts of the land, and as I said, is about a third of our farm, and that moves to a different a third every year with our crop rotation sequence. But other parts of the farm, depending on what next year's crops are going to be, determines what green manures we grow there. And there are some other neat ones, like a forage radish. Here's something people might not think of as a green manure, but this is a great one because basically it is a tall radish with a very strong taproot that goes down maybe 4 feet or so and brings up nutrients from way down below. And it protects the soil all winter. It does winter kill. And again, it has created a more fertile soil for you over winter without your having to do anything but rake it aside in the spring. And in the book, I give a whole long list of these. A lot of them are legumes like the vetch. A lot of them are just regular plants like the radish. And some of them are grasses. They all help.
And it's really well explained in the book if anyone really wants to get into it and understand the background. But if you just want to take all your advice, it's easy enough to do, too. I was really interested in the pictures are beautiful. I'm assuming these are all pretty much on your farm, right? Four Season Farm?
Yes. My wife is a very good photographer, and she has taken all the pictures for all of my books, and they greatly benefit from her skill.
Yeah, they are very, very nice. I was really surprised that I'm looking at a picture of a garden, and you've got your, it looked like it probably was some kind of a cabbage or something, but in between is another crop of something, so you don't even see the soil. Is that the way you generally grow, or was that a certain special case?
Okay, that is a green manure technique known as undersowing. And so after the cabbage was growing, I would go through that field underneath the cabbage leaves with a little seed dispenser and spread clover seed. And that would come up in the understories. And if you wait too long to do this, the crop that we're talking about is cabbage, will smother out this undersown legume. But if you time it right, the legume will get established, the cabbage or whatever crop the other crop is will grow together, and you will have both. You will have an improved soil and a heck of a harvest of cabbages.
And that's such a great idea. You also have one with peppers and arugula and keeps the weeds down, I'm assuming?
No, that was, I think that was taken as a joke picture and somehow it ended up in the book. But I did know I needed to have a whole lot of arugula ready for an order in May 1 year, and I didn't have any extra land, so I just went to a bed where I had planted peppers and undersowed, sprinkled the arugula seed in under the peppers and raked it in, and I could go through that pepper bed with my knife and cut and harvest all of that arugula, and then it was out of the way. It was no longer competing with the peppers. And so it was a great way to get two crops off the same land.
It's lovely. We're talking with Elliot Coleman. He has over 50 years of experience in all aspects of organic gardening. His new book is called The Self-Feed Farm, A Return to the Roots of the Organic Method. What questions do you have about organic vegetable gardening? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Next week on the show, Diana Alfith will be back to answer your gardening questions. And then in the last half hour, we'll talk with the author of a fun new book called Chainsaw Love. And yes, it's about chainsaws. Hope you can join us for that because, you know, everybody wants a chainsaw. But right now we're talking about organic garden and gardening with Elliot Coleman. Let's take a call. Pam in Kellogg, Minnesota. Hi, Pam.
Good morning. I have been gardening a very, very, very long time and have never heard of this. I was visiting with a gardener that sells produce this summer, and I asked him how he got to get such good results. And he said he spreads his whole fields with Epsom salts. And I have never heard of that in my life, and I wonder if your guest has.
Well, I have. I don't know about you, Elliot.
Epsom salts contain one of the nutrients often recommended that you add to the soil.
So is it a good thing or a bad thing, or it just depends?
Yeah, I suspect like anything soluble, and Epsom salts are soluble, you can overdo it by adding too much, and that may unbalance whatever balance you might need between that and other nutrients. But for the most part, if someone tells you they've been successful with it, you should listen to them, because they probably know a lot more than you do.
And find out how much they use, right?
Yes.
Yes. Dennis in Two Rivers emailed to ask if organically grown plants help each other. Oh, I'm not quite sure what he means by that.
Oh, well, as somebody who's been doing this for a long time, I will tell you that one of the first things I learned, and it was from Rodale's Organic Farming or Gardening magazine back when I started, was all the stuff about how organic gardening grows plants that are healthy enough to ward off pests.
Yes.
And I thought that was a fabulous thing. And it turned out the more I experimented with it, the more it was true that it was possible to grow fields of carrots or beets or lettuce and other things without pests being, you know, destroying everything. That would, for the most part, they were ignoring it. And the only crop that hasn't proven in my experience to be totally true with is the potato and the potato beetle. I still see occasional potato beetle problems, even when I think I have done everything correct. But if that's the only problem I have, I'm pretty content.
For sure. There are a lot of people that would be very jealous of just having that particular problem. But you have mentioned in your book, too, that that a healthy soil creates healthy plants that are able to fend off diseases and insects.
Yes, and there is a whole lot of evidence on this in the published studies. And there are a number of researchers in Holland, and I've been fascinated by the stuff they have written. In fact, it almost seems too good to be true. But if certain things fall into place, like you have put the right type of organic matter into the soil, and it breaks down in a way that makes its nutrients easily available to the next crop, and the next crop wants them, and so on and so on. It does work. Miraculous as it may seem, it's actually true.
Mm-hmm. And we've heard that before from people who have talked about how important the healthy soil is. So for those who are growing organically, a lot of it's like, well, I have to control these things. But a lot of times you don't have to worry about controlling it if you do it right.
That has been my experience.
Yeah,
yes, Jill.
Yeah, for sure. So let's talk a little bit about rotating plants. Very important, rotating those crops. How do you decide what crops can be planted when you rotate crops? So how do you intertwine them, basically?
Yeah, years ago, I read that the University of Rhode Island had done 50 years of studies on the effect of preceding crops on subsequent crops. And I went to my local university library where they had all those old studies, and I read them. And it was absolutely fascinating that if you planted onions and then followed them with cabbage. Both the onions and the cabbage did spectacularly. If you planted cabbage and followed it with onions, the onions just grew very poorly because they didn't grow well after whatever the cabbage had done to the soil. So there were a lot of, non-scientific, but obviously fascinating connections going on out there between previous crops and subsequent crops. And the basic rule of crop rotation is not to plant the same crop in the same space year after year. But if there is a positive, it would be, for the most part, if you grow almost any crop after a legume, and a legume that has been inoculated so it has nodules on its roots, it will most likely grow a fantastic crop.
And that makes total sense. And we had mentioned tilling before, and when you till, you don't go down very long far, do you?
No. All of the studies that I've found suggest that organic matter wants to be mixed in just into the top 4 inches of the soil. And that's because oxygen is an important factor in the breaking down of that organic matter, which is what you want to have happen. In fact, when I read a lot about the no-till literature, they're acting as if tilling is going to enhance the breakdown of the organic matter that you till under. And that is 100% true, and that's why I'm doing it, because if I put organic matter into the soil, I want it to break down so its nutrients are available then for another generation of crops.
Yeah, exactly. Deb emailed to ask, how important it is it to have your soil tested?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm the wrong person to ask that question of, Jill, because I had the soil tested once when I first started here. That's how I found out about that 4.3 pH, but I haven't done it since. And I guess I have to say I test the soil with my eyes.
Uh-huh.
And I've been doing it long enough that I can tell by how well the plants are growing, whether the soil is doing what it needs to be doing.
Right. Ruth in Chippewa Falls has a call for us. Go ahead, Ruth.
You were talking about potato beetles, and I grew potatoes, and I left black nightshade in the garden. I always left a few plants in the potatoes. I never saw a potato bug in my garden.
Okay, thanks, Ruth. Combination planting. Have you experimented with that, Elliot?
I haven't, like she has, but the people who have surprised me on potato beetles are friends in Europe who, and this is the other fascinating thing, during the Second or First World War, I forget which, we dropped potato beetles on the enemy in Germany because we knew they used a lot of potatoes and didn't have them over there. And potato beetles have been a problem in Europe since then.
Oh.
But on a friend's farm in Holland, he told me that when he started growing, he had a problem. He changed his crop rotation to try and get more organic matter into the soil. And he got rid of the potato beetle problem, and he had never seen it since.
Excellent. Well, Elliot, this has gone so fast. We're finished. We really appreciate you taking the time to being with us and sharing all of your years of experience with us.
Well, Jill, it's been my pleasure. You're an excellent host, and you know how to ask all the right questions.
Well, thank you for having all the right answers. Again, Elliot Coleman has been our guest, and his book is called The Self-Fed Farm and Garden, A Return to the Roots of the Organic Method.